And you got Rodin's credit, which is good.
Yeah, the Rodin's, which is a lot later. Well, and in between them, I mean, there was a lot of stuff in between them that just didn't happen. After Blowout, the agent I got after Blowout, she was a small-time lit agent. And what you want from an agent is somebody who can hype the little bit that you've done and is well-connected enough that she can talk to somebody and hype that into another gig. She didn't have those kind of connections. And I fell into a gig. RKO was trying to, for the umpteenth time, resurrect its production arm. And they had bought the rights on a, well, originally a couple of wannabe producers had bought the rights on this novel. They wanted a writer they weren't going to have to pay. And the Palma credit sounded like a lot to them. Ooh, and we could get them for nothing. but it eventually wound up at RKO, and I wound up working for RKO and actually getting paid. But then the movie didn't happen. And there was a bunch of those. Some were, very few of them were on that scale. Most of them were for very, very small companies. Some were for things that people that weren't even companies. They were like wannabe producers. One, I did five scripts, I think, for a guy who was a refugee from Canon Films after they collapsed. He was one of their lawyers. He'd run off to Florida to try to get into the direct-to-video business. So I did a bunch of junk for him, none of which ever got shot. So there was altogether, I think I did almost two, counting Blowout, I did almost two dozen scripts, and I think four or five of them got made, and I have a credit on one, and that's Rodin's.
Yeah, it's so weird talking to screenwriters sometimes. Like, you look at their CV, and it's like, you know, what have you been doing for the last 20 years? And it's like, well, I ghost wrote this, and this didn't happen, da-da-da-da-da. And it's like, you know, you look at your the actual stuff that's produced, and it's like, you got three credits. How the hell do you support yourself on three credits? It's like, well, I've been working the whole time, but just nothing ever gets made.
and you know, I wasn't making the third gig I did was for a guy who, God bless him, he and I became terrific friends. It was Bill Persky. Billy was out of TV. Billy had been a writer on the old Dick Van Dyke Show. Then he elevated into producing, and he produced That Girl. And when I met him, he was also directing, and he was doing Kate and Allie. So he hired me out of the blue. My agent was handling old rights on a book. And when she sold him the rights on the book, she pitched me. We met, and the guy is just a sweetheart. And we've had a 25-year relationship since then. We've written a couple of scripts, can't get them made. And they're some of the best things I've ever written, and a lot of that is because from working with him. I mean, this is a guy who really knows his stuff. But he's living on residuals. I'm living on an adjunct's pay. So it's more frustrating for me, I think, than it is for him.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, did you write the Versace murders?
I forgot that one did get made. That Canon refugee, I had done, I think, three for him. As I said, none of which got made, but he liked the fact that I could turn a script around fast. I don't think it was 2 or 3 days after Gianni Versace was shot. He calls up. The guy's name was Sam Lupowitz. He says, I want to be the first guy to make a movie about the Versace murder. Sam, they haven't even caught the guy yet. It doesn't matter. We can at least get started. And it was kind of a creepy, vulture-y thing to do. But I was also getting married and paying for my own wedding. So I reluctantly said okay. He sent me a bunch of news clippings. By the time I said okay, Conanin had killed himself, so the story had an ending. So I banged out a script in 6 days. And as I was doing it, I realized two things. One, that there really was a story worth telling in this. Because even as fast as it was slamming it together, and the research was kind of superficial, it was a fascinating look on this American obsession with fame. Because Gianni Versace was a guy, the guy earned what he had. He worked hard. He was very creative. He wasn't at all what I thought he was going to be. I mean, this was a guy who had a huge library and sometimes liked nothing better than to sit home and read. Granted, it was in an enormous, beautifully appointed house, but he wasn't some glitz glam character. Cunanan, on the other hand, was a guy who had no real talent but wanted to live that life. And I thought that was a great story. The second thing that came to me was, and these guys are not the guys to tell it. I know that they're not going to have the money to do it right, and there's no way doing it this fast you can do it right. So I called up Sam, and I says, I'll tell you what. I'll keep the front-end money. You keep the back-end money. Hire yourself a rewrite guy with it, and give him the screen credit. I don't want a credit. Are you sure? Yeah, I'm pretty sure. 5-6 months go by. They're ready to shoot. I actually start seeing stories about this in the press. There was a New York Times Magazine actually did a thing on this. And I'm starting to wonder, did I make a tactical error backing out of this? And then it wasn't Entertainment Tonight, but it was one of those shows. They were going to do a piece on it. And now I'm really thinking, you're an idiot. You might have integrity, but you're an idiot. Then they showed a clip. No, you did the right thing. It was Menachem Golan did all the rewrites and then directed it. And he's not exactly one of cinema's great artists. No. And I know they lied about the budget. I think they had half the money that they claimed. I think he said he was doing it for $5 million, and they really had something like between $2 million and $3 million. And it was awful. They got no distribution in the United States. I don't know that they got any real distribution anywhere except in Italy, and there was a video deal with an overseas company. They couldn't even get a video deal in the United States. You know how bad you had to be back then to not get even a video deal?
In 1998, when video was still...
Yep.
Yeah.
That bad. So I was... It helped pay for my wedding. What can I say? But man, that stunk. He sent me a cassette. And even at the last minute, I mean, he was trying to be nice. Are you sure you don't want a credit? No, Sam, I'm good. I'm good. I really don't deserve it, thinking nobody deserves this.
If only De Palma would have been so thoughtful.
Yeah, I couldn't get the one I wanted, and I had a fight to stay off the one I didn't want. So there was a, how many did I do? Of the five I did, it was that. I worked on a project called Photographing Fairies. A friend of mine had written the source novel, and he hired me to do a draft. And then the company that ultimately optioned it bounced me. I worked on a TV movie that Nick Pileggi actually wrote. And when I got hired because Nick, they needed an initial draft, and Nick was in the hospital. So they needed something, because they were facing a deadline. They had to be able to turn in a draft. So I did an early draft. And then when Nick got better, he came in. That was fun, because he was a nice guy. I had met him once or twice. And I was working for a guy named Sonny Grasso. Sonny was one of the real French Connection cops. He was the one Roy Scheider played. And when Sonny retired, because he'd been a consultant on The French Connection, then he started getting hired as a consultant on other crime movies. And so when he retired, he just moved over into that line of business. And Bill Persky, who I talked about earlier, he introduced me to Sonny. And Sonny and I developed a relationship where every once in a while I could actually get paid for something. Yeah, also a really nice guy. He's still more cop than producer. Somebody once told me, it might have even been Billy, if you're in a room full of guys with guns, you want Sonny there. If you're in a room full of guys in suits, then he starts to panic.
I have one more question for you.
Sure.
What is Dinosaur Babes?
When was this? Is it back in the early 90s? I answered an ad in Hollywood Reporter. Somebody was looking for scripts. And it was this young guy, George Barnes, had set up a minuscule direct-to-video company in Florida. And he had optioned something of mine, which ultimately didn't get made, another one of those. But we had developed a really nice friendship. George and I, we actually did become friends. And one of their fledgling projects was this thing called Dinosaur Babes. And they needed help putting the contracts together. They wanted somebody to look over the script and give them some notes. So I did that. And since I wasn't going to get paid, they gave me a co-executive producer credit. But the movie, they made the movie on a shoestring. They had found this guy, Brett Piper. Actually, you can find him online. I think he has a site. And they had bought a short, an animated short of Brett's, and saw a reel of special effects footage. And Brett was a master of old-fashioned special effects, stop motion, front projection, forced perspective. He could do all that old Ray Harryhausen stuff. And they were wondering, the guy is such a wizard. And I saw some of the footage, and I agreed with him. Why is this guy living in his mother's basement? So they get a couple of $100,000 together to make the movie, and then they find out why, because he has no people skills. And he also has no story sense. You know, they thought this was going to be a kind of a campy Roger Corman-esque thing, you know, like Teenage Caveman. But according to them, Brett was taking it seriously, which kind of threw everybody. And then at one point, I don't even know what the fight was over, but he threw a fit and knocked himself in his room, and George actually had to direct for a couple of days. So the movie, I think he sold it. Blockbuster bought a couple of thousand copies. You know, they made their money back, and that was it. But that was what Dinosaur Babes was. It was kind of like a really low-rent 1 million BC. Nobody as pretty as Raquel. I think they were casting it off the beach.
Oh, really? Just going out there and looking for pretty girls?
Yeah. I mean, they didn't, to save money, they didn't even have sync sound. And since a lot of them were not professional actors, they ad-libbed. So later when they were trying to loop the sound in, nobody could remember what they'd said. So they were trying to read lips. And there are parts where it looks like the old Steve Reeves Hercules movies. Loincloths and unsynchronized lips.
Sounds like something I'm going to have to track down now.
Yeah, if you could find a copy, I would really be impressed. Because I don't even think George has a copy. I think it was something everybody was just trying to put behind them.
I'll see what I can do.
But you take the gigs that you can get.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
You know, I'm not a Kiva Goldsmith. If it comes and you're going to pay, I have limits. There's things I won't do. After Sam Lupowitz collapsed in Florida, he disappeared owing a lot of people money. Then he showed up. I get a call from him in Los Angeles where he was trying to put together a package of soft porn flicks for some cable channel. And I said, well, that's my limit. I won't go there.
Now, actually, looking at Rodents, that looks totally right up my alley. And what a great cast, too.
Especially for the money we had. And it's not. It's a nice little B. It'll remind you of the old RKO B movies from the 50s. Rick King, who directed it, really got a lot of mileage out of not a lot of money. Because out of the 1.6, they had to give Hopper $600,000 up front. So they really went into the shoot with $1 million.
This is right. He's still hot at this time. Like, is this right before Speed or right afterwards?
It's actually a couple years after. As I understood it, he was working steadily. You know, he'd be bouncing back and forth between big pictures and small pictures. So he was working all the time. And I was very flattered because the way they said it to me was, look, he gets these all the time, so he gets to pick. He picked yours. So that was very flattering. And the circumstances under which they had to shoot it, I think it was like only in a 10-11 day shooting schedule. And Sarandon, who's also one of the stars, he was already on something else. And then Dennis had to get shot very quickly because he had something coming up. So they shot him first. Sarandon gets free. They shoot the one or two scenes they have together. Then Dennis flies off, and they have to shoot all of Chris's stuff. But when you watch it, I mean, I'm not going to say this is Chinatown, but I guess it's a nice little B, and it doesn't feel as rushed and as on the fly as I know the shoot had to be, and a lot of that credit goes to Rick King, who directed it. I mean, if there's anything wrong with it other than the fact that they could have used a little bit more money, There were things I did wrong in the script, but on their end, they really, I thought they pulled it off. Yeah, you know, I keep meaning to get a copy. They gave me a VHS copy, and I keep meaning to say, you know, it's not like you can watch it anywhere.
I still have a VCR.
You're a good man, Mike.
Yeah, well, I still have an old TV. People always make fun of me because I have a Blu-ray player that my TV is so old it can't hook into. Yeah.
And do you tell anybody about the 8-track player you got hidden in the garage?
It's between you and me. I'm still transferring over all my old cassettes. Yeah.
I have kids now, so I don't get to see anything. I mean, I've seen every damn superhero and animated flick for the last 12 years, but the only way I get to see anything I like is I got to wait for everybody in the house to be asleep.
Yeah, my wife's taking a nap right now, so I'm about to go up and watch the movie that we're interviewing Lloyd Kaufman at 9 o'clock tonight, and I need to rewatch the movie that we're talking to him about. Speaking of Menachem Golan, it's one of his... One of his old Israeli films before he started Troma.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting one.
Well, when he was shooting Versace, I'm trying to remember, there was a hostage crisis down in Chile, I think. No, Peru. It was in Peru. And I got a call, they conference called me. Sam was always glomming on the headlines thinking that was going to sell a movie. And they wanted to do something about the thing down in Peru. And again, he says, "Cause we know you can turn one around fast." Wanted me, so I got the two of them. And Menachem Golan had this on the phone. It almost sounds like somebody pretending to be Menachem Golan because he had this very, very thick burlesque accent. And he must be something in a meeting because he's all head up about doing this. And I'm telling him as I'm politely trying to say no. And I said, you know, I don't know anything about the situation. I don't know anything about Peru. I don't know anything about Lima. We will send you to Lima. And then in the background, I hear Tightwad Sam going, "Menachem, Menachem, we're not sending anybody to Lima. We will send him to Lima. He will do the research." No, he won't.
I've been helping out this guy, Graydon Clark, with his autobiography. And he is the guy who made the one of two Lombada films back in the early 90s. And I think he shot and edited at the same time, and they turned it around in like 11 days or something insane like that. Like, I mean, like with script and everything, I think it was like a 3-week period that they made this Lombada film. And it was all so that this is right after Golan and Globus had their parting of the ways. And so Golas was going to make one Yeah, so they're both making these, and, you know, of course, Golan's just like, "We got to beat that bastard. That bastard army's going down."
I once interviewed a guy named Mike Elliott. Mike had been Roger Corman's head of production from the late 80s into the early 90s. And what? I'd give my eye teeth to have worked there then. Because it sounds like it sounds like something you would make up. Mike said he had, because he was listed as producer, on so many Flint films, because they were just grinding these things out, he doesn't remember most of them. And when people come up to him and say, "Oh, I saw your name on..." "Really? That was one of ours? I did that?" And even, he says, even when he looks them up, no memory at all. Because I think he's, on IMDb, only has a fraction of them. I think his name is actually on a couple of hundred of these flicks. And he went in there as an intern, wound up as head of production. And as head of production, he was getting paid about when I was at HBO, we used to pay an executive secretary. But it sounds like if you were going to do it for the fun of it, that was the place to be.
Well, I just saw that they greenlit that biopic comedy thing that Joe Dante's doing, all about the making of The Trip. That drunk movie from the late 60s. I think that sounds awesome. I hope that happens.
I mean, when he's gone, somebody ought to do a movie about that man.
Oh, yeah. Well, that documentary that they did a few years ago was amazing. Did you see that one?
I had seen one years ago. I didn't see that one. But it was, what a factory. I mean, you can actually find the interview on Sound On Sight, because that's where I write for. It's just hysterical. And then I interviewed one of the guys who wrote a couple of scripts for them, and him talking about his experience. Like I said, it's just hysterical. You can't believe that even in the 90s, people were making movies like that. And there was actually a certain old Hollywood quality to it, because it ran like the old movie factories instead of the way that the studios run. But the screenwriter's name was Travis Rink. And Travis would tell you, he says, you could tell people just loved what they were doing. It's not like anybody had any illusions about what they were making, but they were all young and they were all getting to do it. And as I was interviewing them both, I was really jealous that they'd had that experience. I only ever get to talk to people on the phone.
Well, cool. Oh, there we go. I found your author page on Sound On Sight. So I will link over to that when we post this interview, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
So folks can read your stuff. And if there's anything else you want me to link to or whatever, just let me know, and I will gladly do that.
Well, once they're in there, because I think they'll see my credits, there's a book I'm very proud of called Overkill, The Rise and Fall of Thriller Cinema, which is, I think, still available on Amazon. That was a lot of fun to do. I thought it was going to take 8 months. It took 3 years, because I'm that good a judge of how hard things are. But the fun thing about doing it was I got to relive a lot of memories in the process. I think maybe that's why it took so long, was I was reluctant to end it. Of course, then when I got up to the 90s, I really wanted to end it. Because the book runs from the 30s up to, well, the book came out in 07, so up to the early 2000s, and how the thriller genre changed in all its stripes. And, what happened was I had taken a mental health day from work. It was summer. I was standing in a multiplex looking up at the 52 movies listed up there going, now they're all thrillers, which is what I love. How come there's nothing up there I want to see? And why does everything have a 3 or a 4 after it? And I was sincerely curious. How did it get, say, from Chinatown to this? And that turned out to be a very more involved question than I had thought. But at the end, I realized that I had grown up at the right time. Not only were the 60s and 70s a great creative peak, but in the pre-cable days, and there's actually a post called The Gray Ones Fade to Black is about this, because of the way syndication worked then, and you probably remember this, we actually used to get a whole hell of a lot more classic films on regular TV. I mean, now it's just TCM. So I had 6 channels, and every day somebody was running something. Now I got 120, and it's hard for me to find something.
Yeah, watching my old, UHF channels in the wee hours of the night or even during the day. You know, we had Bill Kennedy showing movies at 1 o'clock in the afternoon every day on Channel 50. It was always great to see.
Well, in that piece I was talking about, I interviewed Bill Persky, and Billy, because he's older than me, he remembers, because people don't forget. There was no TiVo. There was no VCRs. He said he'd get a call at 1 o'clock in the morning. Treasure of the Sierra Madre's on!
Nice.
Okay, I'll turn it on now. And then you stumble into work all red-eyed. But they had them. It may have been inconvenient as hell, but they had them. And now I'm teaching an intro to film class. And none of my students know more than a handful of movies that predate them. And the movies they do know are biggies. Jaws, Star Wars, The Godfather. But after you get past a dozen of those kind of headliners, nothing. And just trying to find a language to talk to them has been difficult.
You can't say Potemkin Steps and people immediately know what you're talking about.
I know, because I was showing them. It's funny you said that. I was showing them the Odessa Steps thing. And I had to explain. First I had to explain to them Russia. the czar, because none of that means anything. That all of the movies then were silent.
God, it's like you got to teach them history before you can teach them the movies.
So it's been tough. I had taught a similar class once before someplace else. And about 3 weeks in, this one woman, I think she was about 30, asked me, how come you only show us movies we never heard of? And I had to explain to her that most movies were made before you were born. You know, I also tried to explain to her that the idea of a film appreciation class isn't for you to get to watch Titanic again. It's for you to see things that you haven't seen. That seemed to baffle her. Yeah, well, she was bitching. It wasn't fun. But, I mean, they didn't know who... I mean, never mind people like Burt Lancaster, even John Wayne. I've heard of John Wayne. But even if you get into the later years, Steve McQueen, only dimly aware of Paul Newman, you know, from his peak, those names just don't mean anything to them.
You mean the salad dressing guy?
Oh, yeah. Hey, I had one guy said, did you realize this was when Rise of the Planet of the Apes came out? You know, there was a Planet of the Apes movie before that. Oh, yeah, the Tim Burton one.
Oh.
And then God forbid, never mind that, you know, there was a book, too.
Books, what are those?
that came up when we were discussing War of the Worlds. Yeah, I know there was an old movie. No, there was a book. Yeah. So, Mike, you're doing God's work.